You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, January 10th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Rocky Anderson, presidential candidate from the newly formed Justice Party. We'll be on the program. We'll be also talking to Jeff Smith from Occupy Wall Street on the upcoming J17 Occupy Congress actions that will be taking place in Washington, D.C. and around the country. Also today, there's a Republican primary, I guess, in New Hampshire. What are you going to do? Got some fracking stories. Follow up on some stories we did yesterday. Bill Daley leaving the White House as chief of staff. Sort of knew this was going to happen. Not going back to becoming a director at Morgan Stanley. That's going to have to wait until he gets President Obama reelected. You know, he may not go back to Morgan Stanley. Maybe he'll go to... Morgan Stanley or J.P. Morgan? He'll go back to some bank. He'll sit on some board of directors of some bank. Before we get to Rocky Anderson, let's do something from the New Hampshire primaries. Mitt Romney will squeak by. And I say squeak only because the guy practically lived in New Hampshire for years and years. Right next door in Massachusetts. Then maybe Huntsman or Ron Paul. And everybody else gear up for South Carolina. But with former Governor Romney, former Bain executive Romney, was Chris Christie. And Occupy New Hampshire has been very active up in New Hampshire. They just, Newt Gingrich canceled an appearance today because of protesters. We're hoping to talk to some Occupy New Hampshire people tomorrow, get their roundup from what took place in the primaries. But here's Governor Christie. He is interrupted by an Occupy Wall Streeter, and this is how he responds.
That in Washington, D.C. is doing nothing but posturing and bickering and solving nothing for the people who wind up needing to get this done. Really? You know, some may go down tonight, but ain't gonna be jobs, sweetheart. See, it's this confusion. It's this confusion that's out there. Because if she was in New Jersey, like these Jersey girls here, she would know that we've created 60,000 new private sector jobs after John Forsyth killed 120,000.
Now, first off, let's not take his... Something's gonna go down tonight, sweetheart, but it's not going to be jobs. Let's just take his claim of 60,000 new private sector jobs created under his watch. ConservativeNewJersey.com. ConservativeNewJersey.com, which I'm gathering is not a liberal site, unless they... very aptly got that URL.
writes, well, they find basically his claim to be ludicrous. But I'll break it down for what they say. On December 15th, NewJersey.com had a small story on employment gains in New Jersey. In that story, the Labor Department reported the employment figure was 3,881,000. Using this number and subtracting the January 2010 employment figures from it, the net gain since Governor Christie has been in office is 28,400 new jobs in the state. One number of importance, though, is acknowledged that 7,800 of these jobs were in the retail trade, staffing increased only for the holiday season. 28,400 new jobs, not quite 60,000. 25,000 public sector jobs have been lost. 47 out of 51 nationally is New Jersey government job growth rate since January 2010. 45 out of 51 nationally. 45,000 number of permanent jobs Christie cost New Jersey by killing access to the region's core tunnel project. The numbers go on and on. Now, we could respond that way, but maybe we should just respond a little bit more in New Jersey. Like, I don't think so, Chubbs. Or, hey, Tubby Fatbags. I don't think your job record's so good. Or, that's a big fat lie, Christie. What'd you do, eat the truth? Or, what, you got to hire 60,000 people to help you get out of bed in the morning?
You'd go down, Christie, but you wouldn't be able to get back up.
Hey, I'm falling. I can't get back up. I got to say, just to get New Jersey a little bit here, it's probably not so far from Massachusetts. But, the only thing that I could think of when I was looking at that clip was, oh, my God, that's a fat. What a fat. All right, folks. Governor Christie, I don't know if there's room on that ticket for you to be vice president with Mitt Romney, but I wish you all the best of luck. I am sad that you did not run for president this year, because tomorrow would be the day in that alternate universe that you would have said, I'm leaving the race because I've done so poorly. So go back to New Jersey. Have a cannoli. Oh! When we come back, we'll be talking to Rocky Anderson of the Justice Party.
Last night there were skinheads on my lawn. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Some people say that bowling alley's got big lanes.
Got big lanes, got big lanes.
Some people say that bowling alleys all look the same. Not a line that goes here that rhymes with anything.
Anything, anything.
Had a dream last night, but I forget what it was.
We are back on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Rocky Anderson, the presidential candidate from the Justice Party. Welcome to the program, Rocky.
really great to be with you. Thanks very much.
Now, Rocky, let's start. You know, I got to say, back when I was on Air America, I remember you from coming out and being one of the only public officials who made a call to impeach President George Bush. Tell me, just before we get on to your race here, what was behind that?
What was behind it was that our nation was facing one of its saddest, I think, really tragic periods of time. We had been fed incredible lies by our administration, and these weren't just mistakes. These just weren't reliance on bad intelligence. It was a fraud on the American people. Our president wasn't telling him what information was being provided by the intelligence community that was diametrically the opposite of what we, the people in Congress, were being told. And in the course of this, we're committing an illegal war of aggression. It ended up with, the results in terms of the Iraqi people, hundreds of thousands of people dead, maimed, a real tragedy for that country, and a tragedy for ours, and the number of servicemen that were injured and killed and lives ruined, and into the future, the kinds of security problems we're going to be facing for generations because of the hatred it was instilled all over the world. So those kinds of lies are impeachable offenses. There were crimes committed. The surveillance that was taking place without warrants, completely in violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and then the massive human rights abuses. Our nation was reduced to the level of nations who in the past we've been very proud to distinguish ourselves from, that go around kidnapping and torturing and killing people without any semblance of due process. So I saw that our nation was really facing a frightening time, a real transformation in terms of our core values and our constitutional principles. And we're developing this imperial presidency that was assuming for itself unprecedented powers, powers that have never been claimed by the President of the United States before. And Congress was sitting back. The courts were derelict in dismissing cases, which they continue to do on the basis of either the state secrets doctrine or the political question doctrine. There really is no checks and balances system or separation of powers as was contemplated by our founders and which guided our government up until about the last decade. So I just felt like anybody in any position of power, in any leadership position, really needed to stand up and call this for what it was, to challenge it and try to create a movement in this country to awaken the American people and get them to take action. And clearly these were the sorts of offenses that were considered by the founders to be impeachable offenses. That's why impeachment was written into the Constitution. But sadly, I was the only major city mayor in the country advocating for impeachment. And of those mayors I talked to, many of them said they absolutely believe in it. They love what I was doing, but they just didn't want to go out on a limb. They didn't feel like it was their job, their responsibility, that it might be too controversial and it might hurt them politically.
Well,
and as long as we each take that attitude in our lives, we're never going to change anything. That was classic in Ian Esco's play Rhinoceros. Everybody standing back as fascism was creeping into politics in Europe and everybody finding a reason not to stand up and challenge it.
Well, I wanted to wish you a belated thank you and tell you that, you know, at the time I was incredibly impressed. You were mayor of Salt Lake City, Utah at the time, and you came out, and it was very important to hear someone who had some type of official position in politics, and a fairly major one, to speak what was on the mind of many of us. And so I wanted to tell you, start off by telling you I appreciated that. And tell me how you and when you decided to start the Justice Party.
Well, this has evolved during the course of several months of discussions. There was a sense that there needs to be a real second party in this country, a party that's going to help bring about a very different system. Both Republican and Democratic parties are thriving off this very corrupt, disease system that we have now, where corporate interests have their way with our government. It is a true plutocracy, a government that is ruled by the wealthy. We have a pretense of democracy, of course, but the people's interests, the interests of the public, are not being served by and large by our government, either by Congress or by the president. They are caving in day after day to the pressure of the lobbyists on K Street, where hundreds of million dollars are being poured in by special interests, and then, of course, by the campaign contributors upon whom they rely. You just have to follow the money. Why do we not provide the crucial international leadership on climate change that's so necessary to avoid the catastrophic consequences of climate disruption? It's because of the corrupting influence of money coming from the fossil fuels industry. Why did we not achieve major health care reform? Why did we end up with this bastardized plan that where there were so many compromises that we, the American people, are just going to be paying more and more premiums and will still not have universal health care coverage? There will still be, if the Obama plan is fully implemented, 23 million people in this country without any essential health care coverage, when the rest of the industrialized world, every single nation in the industrialized world, not only provides universal health care, but they do it much, much less expensively, and most of them have better medical outcomes.
And so you mentioned climate change and health care reform, and I would imagine there is a whole raft of issues that emanate from that notion that money has corrupted our political process and has corrupted both political parties. What do you intend? I mean, for a moment, it is 2013. We've just inaugurated Rocky Anderson as president. What would you do at that point to begin to deal with this problem?
Well, I would provide the leadership. I'd be speaking directly to the American people, doing everything I can to raise consciousness about how corrupt things are. But I think people generally have that sense of it. I would give the detailed examples. I would show how, for instance, the Congress backed off, watered down this legislation they were recently considering on cutting out federal funds for student loans at a lot of these private colleges that are failing, where students come, they pay high tuitions, they take out loans that are non-dischargeable in bankruptcy, loans that are going to be hanging over their heads perhaps for their entire lives, and yet they get out of these programs and they're not equipped to go work in the areas for which they thought they were getting the education. Congress was going to address it. These private colleges, the big companies that own these places like Goldman Sachs and these other investment banks, they put on the push. They put millions of dollars in their lobbying effort, and they got the legislation watered down. That wasn't in the public interest. So the first thing we need to do is detail all of this, make it transparent, let the American people know how these failures in public policy have come about, and then create the support for a constitutional amendment to overrule the Citizens United case, a bizarre case by a bare majority of the United States Supreme Court, people who call themselves strict constructionists, but are in ways, and in that case certainly, as activist a court as there has ever been. And we need those kinds of fundamental changes in our system. We ought to also have every incentive for public financing and for candidates not to be worrying about going out and bringing in money from all these special interests in order to get elected, but getting the kinds of opportunities through public financing so that they don't rely, so that they're not beholden on the special interests that have been buying both the White House and Congress for their own purposes. And then finally, the public airwaves ought to be utilized to provide free and equal time for all candidates. I saw that in Nicaragua in 1983. We were being told by the Reagan administration that their election was a Soviet-style sham election. Well, they had seven parties that covered the entire political spectrum, and every one of them had free and equal time on national radio and national television. We've never had those kinds of democratic opportunities in our electoral system in this country. So there is plenty to do to clean up the system, get money out of government. Our government should no longer be bought and paid for. It ought to be serving the interests of the American people.
All right. And so let me ask you a little bit about the Justice Party. I mean, is there a platform by the Justice Party? I mean, is there an intention? Do you have an intention to build up the Justice Party? Is this something that you foresee existing after your campaign, one way or another?
Absolutely. This isn't about one person or one campaign. This is about a long-term grassroots movement where the public interest is going to be advocated, where we're going to be fighting to see the government act in the public interest rather than just bow down to those with the money. So the Justice Party, our intention is that it be a major force in United States politics, and that we field candidates at every level, municipal, state, federal races, and presidential candidates in the future, and that we keep this going, that it not be a fringe party, that it not just be viewed as a certain sliver on the left or the right, that it be a party that attracts people from across the political spectrum, because on the issues that we're primarily involved with, free access to the political process, open access, getting people on the ballot, free providing the opportunities for people to vote when there's legislation now that's restricting the capacity of people to vote in many ways. Opening up presidential debates so that it's done truly in an independent way. Right now, the Presidential Debate Commission is a product of, it's a creation solely of the Republican and Democratic Party duopoly, and it's not in the public interest. So these are all things that the Justice Party is going to be addressing. They are developing a formal platform, but there's a lot of information on the party's website that would inform people about what the fundamentals are in terms of the party, why the party was formed. That website is justicepartyusa.org. And then also my website for my campaign is voterocky.org. And I'm limiting campaign contributions to $100. This can be done if everybody participates, if everybody comes together and stands up and does their share. We can pull this off in this country. We've seen in other nations the overthrow of dictatorships where people were putting their lives on the line, utilizing democratized means of communication, this social media to organize people at the grassroots. And they've overthrown their dictatorships. We, too, in this country, utilizing much less expensive, democratized means of communication, if people will envision the changes that we can make, the possibilities of all of us joining together in a people's movement, and everybody doing their share, standing up, supporting this, we can overthrow the dictatorship of corrupt money in our government.
So give me a sense of, at this point, in terms of from a mechanics standpoint, how many states do you anticipate the Justice Party will be on the ballot? I know that in California, the Justice Party needed 103,000Californians to register under the Justice Party by last week. Did that happen? What states do you perceive that you will be able to get onto the ballot?
Well, there in California, there are a number of options. We only formed in December, and California has a January 2nd deadline, which is outrageous. I think it's subject to challenge in the courts. It's a complete deprivation of choice for California voters. I'm sure we didn't meet the deadline. It would have taken not just signatures on petitions, but people actually registering as Justice Party members. But so we can challenge that in the courts and perhaps get more time to achieve that requirement of getting people registered or getting over a million people to sign petitions. But there's also a possibility of me running as an independent based on getting a number of signatures on petitions, or also the possibility of my name being there on the line reserved for another party. There's the Peace and Freedom Party in California. Certainly there are a lot of values, a lot of places where we have similar concerns, and I might be able to get on the ballot as the candidate for the Peace and Freedom Party.
So, I mean, when you decided to run, and you decided somewhat late, I mean, Justice Party forms in December, you've got all of these sort of mechanical hurdles facing you. What is, at the end of the day, come November 3rd, I mean, what is the agenda? I mean, are you hoping to have built this party, or to have headed down that road? Are you hoping to have the opportunity to express these, I'm looking at your issues and policies on your site, and these are all issues that I would agree with and subscribe to. What is the ultimate agenda, both short, mid, and long term?
Well, Sam, people talk about us getting into this late. There are almost no other nations that carry on campaigns as long as we do in the United States. This actually, if we get everybody working and we get people to join this grassroots movement, this can be done. We can be a major force in this election. And who knows? There might be the kind of miracle where we pull the people together. Who expected that the Egyptian people would be able to come together in a people's movement and overthrow their dictator? But even if that doesn't happen, there's a great book by Tom Friedman and Michael Mandelbaum entitled That Used to Be Us. And they end that book by calling for the creation of a major new political party in this country. And they point out that if you're able to get out and address these issues and look the American people in the eye and tell them, look, the Democrats and Republicans are lying to you, and they can't do otherwise because they're bought off by all these special interests. And here are the kinds of things that we need to do to get back to the American formula for greatness, the kinds of commitments that we need to make, and the changes that we need to make. Get out of these wars. Stop wasting so much money on these wasteful defense budgets. Well, excuse me, the defense is a total, it's the wrong word to use. These are military budgets. We haven't used our military for defense purposes in a long time. But we can make these changes in our system of government when we all pull together. And as they point out in that book, even if the alternative party candidate loses, that kind of a movement can have a greater impact on our nation and on our world than perhaps even the candidate who ends up prevailing, because the American people have gotten behind it. And they give several examples of when that's happened, with Teddy Roosevelt when he ran as a Progressive Party candidate. Almost his entire platform ended up being adopted after his loss as an alternative party candidate. Ross Perot was the only person, when he first ran, talking about our budget problems and deficits and how that was all impacting the American people and the future of this country. Well, Bill Clinton ended up building up surpluses. He ended his term with major surpluses in the budget. A lot of that has to be attributed to what Ross Perot did and the attention that was paid then by the American people on those issues. So we can make great changes if everybody hangs together and supports this party and my campaign.
I got to say, I imagine Thomas Friedman is talking about Americans elect, but be that as may, the principle still remains. Let me get your perspective. There's a lot of in the progressive community, a lot of people who are talking, and there's a big argument about the value of Ron Paul in this election. Not so much to be directly supported, but in terms of his espousing the criticism of the American empire. And I see, and this is something that in maybe perhaps not so many words, but you are arguing the same thing. I mean, what do you say to those disaffected progressives and liberals who see Ron Paul as providing at least some voice there? What do you say to those people?
Well, I say to those people that Ron Paul stands for a lot of things that you will absolutely disagree with. The reason Ron Paul has had, I think, as much attention and support as he has is he's the only one among those that the mainstream media are paying any attention to that is calling to get out of these wars, to not go around the world dominating both economically and militarily. But he's also a guy who says that government doesn't have a role in so many areas, including the regulation of pollution, environmental programs. He says the answer to our environmental problems is strict observance of private property rights. I think that's just a crock. Ron Paul is a total isolationist. He would not advocate for the United States to join with the international community to intervene to end genocides. It was bad enough that President Clinton sat on his hands during the genocide in Rwanda in 1994 when he could have provided the leadership along with France in the United Nations and put an end to that butchery. We had a legal obligation to do it. We've adopted, ratified the Genocide Convention. And if we're going to meet the promises of never again that we made after the Holocaust, that kind of isolationism is so destructive in the long term. And I don't see our moral obligations ending with political boundaries the way that Ron Paul does. And I certainly believe the government has a major role in ending racial discrimination. Ron Paul thinks that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibiting discrimination on account of race and public accommodations is somehow an infringement on our personal freedoms. I think that is just downright bizarre. He's calling for the kind of government that is, I think, unrecognizable to most of us. And progressives should reject that, and they should embrace those who have been fighting against these wars, as I have, for years, who have been advocating for a restoration of the rule of law, as I have for years. I've been working on these issues. I formed High Road for Human Rights right after I left the mayor's office, addressing these issues, but I was addressing them also when I was in the mayor's office. And for 21 years before I was mayor, I was representing people who had been injured as a result of corporate and governmental abuses of power. So there is a great option here for people who are concerned about these issues. It's not Ron Paul. It's the Justice Party. And in this instance, it's Rocky Anderson running for president of the United States.
I know you just got just a couple minutes here, but I've heard you address this on in other interviews that you had some hesitation about jumping into the race because you didn't want to necessarily be the difference between President Obama, let's say, and whoever ends up being the Republican nominee. Tell me about that decision, that struggle, and what your feelings are on it now that you've been campaigning for a couple months.
Well, I did struggle with that, and then it occurred to me, we're never going to see a change in our system of government. All we're going to do is move around the players according to the rules that have been set in this really corrupt game called government in the United States. And we'll never see that major shift to get the impact, the corrupting impact of money out of our government if we won't stand up for that kind of a change. And the only way to do that is with an alternative party. And that's why I decided not only should we do this, we have to do this if we're going to change things around in this country. We're going to see a continuation. I mean, my goodness, the lesser of two evils, according to most people now, signs legislation and actually advocated for legislation that gives him the power to indefinitely detain even American people without charges, without legal representation, without a trial. It's absolutely un-American. He's turned his back on the rule of law in so many different ways. He's supported Wall Street. He's surrounded himself with Goldman Sachs people. He has turned his back in so many ways on the American people, and especially his base, who are completely disillusioned now.
And lastly, give me your sense of Occupy Wall Street, because, you know, I personally have found Occupy Wall Street to provide a has opened up what I perceive as another avenue in which to make that change that is running on a parallel and in many respects distinct track from electoral politics.
Well, except we're still going to have elections, and I would urge anybody involved in the Occupy movement, keep doing what you're doing, because we haven't been addressing these issues. The Occupy movement has brought more attention to the economic disparity in this country, which is greater than it's been at any time since the 1920s. There have been people writing about it. There have been people who have had that sense, but the Occupy movement has brought real focus on these injustices. And there is tremendous confluence here between what we're working on and what the Occupy movement has done. And I'm very proud of everyone who's been involved in that. I've been very supportive. And I think that we provide the electoral component. We provide the option for those in the Occupy movement, those who support the Occupy movement. We provide the electoral component to getting these solutions in place and making the kinds of fundamental changes that we need to see in our government. And I might also say, don't just listen to people and what they say during campaigns. Take a look at what they've done with their lives. Take a look at where their passions are, what their core beliefs are, what their commitments are, because that's going to be the best sign in terms of what they're going to do once they're in office. President Obama, he had none of this. He had no executive experience. He wasn't a mayor who was standing up on these issues. Even when he was in the United States Senate, he wasn't standing up against torture. He voted consistently for the illegal occupation of Iraq. He switched his vote. He said he was going to join a filibuster to block retroactive immunity for the telecom companies who had worked with the Bush administration and its illegal surveillance program. And then as soon as he got the Democratic nomination, he turned 180 degrees, betrayed that promise, and voted for that immunity. That kind of immunity is so consistent with everything else he has done when he says, let's look forward, not backwards, and basically ignore war crimes, basically ignore the felonies committed in engaging in illegal surveillance on the American people. What kind of leadership is that? This country has been absolutely transformed in the last 10 years. The two Bush administrations and now the Obama administration. And both administrations going into the courts and getting cases dismissed when they're brought by victims of torture, those who challenge illegal surveillance, getting those cases dismissed on the basis of the state secrets doctrine, which in essence is rendering completely neutral the courts as a check on abuses of executive power. That spells tyranny. It spells an imperial presidency that's unprecedented in this country, and we all need to get back to our core values in this country and honor our Constitution, honor what's been very best about our nation, honor the kinds of things that made our nation distinguished from those totalitarian human rights abusing countries from whom we used to so proudly distinguish ourselves, but now whose practices we seem to be replicating in many instances. We just have that opportunity to do this, and I think we've got a real obligation of the future to get the job done.
The sites are voterocky.org, and the Justice Party is at justicepartyusa.org. We'll put both those at the site at majority.fm. Rocky Anderson, I appreciate your coming on. I hope to see you on that debate stage with President Obama and whoever ends up being the Republican nominee. I wish you good luck.
Sam, thank you very much. Great to talk to you again.
Great to talk to you, too. All right, we've got to take a break, folks. And when we do, we will come back with Jeff Smith of Occupy Wall Street, extended show today, so that we can talk about the actions that are going to be taking place next week in Washington. And I have a special request of you when we have Jeff on in just a moment. Back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Apparently, there's a primary happening today in New Hampshire between the Republican candidates. But far more important, frankly, in my mind, is what's going to be taking place over the next week in Washington, D.C. That is the Occupy Congress action, which will be following up the day after OccupyTheDream.org, which is being put together to celebrate Martin Luther King Day. On the phone is Jeff Smith from the Occupy Wall Street media team. Jeff, how are you?
Hi, Sam. Good to be here.
And, of course, everyone knows that your Twitter handle is Don't Be a Putz. And so tell me, you're heading down to Washington on Tuesday. Is that correct?
I am, actually. I'm actually hoping to go down on Sunday and make some of the Occupy the Dream on Martin Luther King Day, and then stay for the entire week. There's going to be actions, actually, not just on the 17th, but the 18th, 19th, and 20th. I think ending with on the 20th and 21st are Citizens United protests. But 17 is definitely going to be a big day of action. There's going to be all kinds of stuff, mic checks all over the city. And we're at some point going to try and basically protest all three branches of government, the Congress, go to the Supreme Court steps and do a demonstration there, and then before the end of the day, head to the White House. So, you know, there are no targets that will be immune from the spotlight of Occupy Wall Street on that day.
And why? I mean, give me a sense of is there a broader sort of strategic reason why? I mean, obviously, January 17th is the 4-month anniversary of Occupy. Winter, I think we all speculated, was going to be sort of the quieter time in terms of this movement, at least this winter anyways. Why J-17 as opposed to F-17 to head to Washington?
Well, it is the first day of Congress for the new year. And so because it's between, you know, New Hampshire and South Carolina, there's a couple of week gap in there. We may actually get to have some news coverage that's other than the primaries on the Republican side. And frankly, you know, our Congress people just don't work that often. And so, you know, when they come to work for a whole week, it's a good time to actually show up and let them know that we're interested in what they're doing there.
That's an impressive level of sophistication in terms of, at least from the news media standpoint, because I can tell you, just as you know, as someone who digests this stuff professionally, the next week is the week where there'll be no news. Or at least they'll be rehashing the same old, you know, polls as to what's going on in South Carolina. So give me a sense. I mean, what is your understanding? What's happening with Occupy the Dream?
You know, it was something that was set up separately from the people I've been dealing with for the 17th. And so, sadly, I'm not sure exactly what the day's events are. So I'll just sort of be a spectator and participant on that. I think that one's definitely not quite as, you know, strident of an action. It's really more of a, you know, solidarity sort of thing and celebrating at least the ideals of what Martin Luther King was about. I mean, I think to a certain degree, his legacy has been sanitized to a degree. And I think that his real legacy is a radicalism that has been sort of wiped away. I think of it in the same way as Muhammad Ali, now that he's basically unable to speak. It's almost like his legacy is being rewritten as this sort of friendly character when he was also quite a radical. And so I think what we'll see is that Occupy Wall Street will try and maintain that level of, you know, that side of the message for Martin Luther King Day. And I think that will probably be different than what people think of about that person and that holiday.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about Occupy the Dream is they're occupying the Federal Reserve. You know, in about a dozen different cities across the country. And people do, I think, tend to neglect the Martin Luther King's legacy of calling for not just civil rights in the sense of rights for black and oppressed minorities, but also social justice. In addition to, obviously, his arguing against the war. Turning back to Occupy the Congress, you're going to be staging protests at the Supreme Court, presumably around the Capitol, near the White House. What other actions do you anticipate? Is there is it one of those things where you don't necessarily want to be terribly specific about what's happening this far out, or what?
Well, there will definitely be some, you know, individual actions that are on a smaller scale that are kind of stealth, and, you know, you're going to see people show up at, you know, there's so many rich targets in D.C. that I think you're going to potentially see some, like, you know, potentially like a surprise projection a la the Verizon building and the, you know, Brooklyn Bridge. Someone pulls something like that off somewhere in the city, and you may see mic checks popping up in, you know, places literally dozens at the same time throughout the city at a certain, you know, time or interval. And but one of the things that we do have set up that's pretty well planned out is like a multi-occupation General Assembly, because certainly this call was basically made nationwide to try and get people from Occupy movements to come. And so I think it will be a networking session in a sense, and it'll allow us to kind of talk about big picture stuff, you know, with representatives from all over the country. I mean, Occupy Wall Street in New York has always had the advantage of many, many people came from all over the country to participate in this. But I think for other people around the country, it will definitely add to their experience to meet people that have different experiences in their cities. And that's really the next level of organizing, is to create a real network around the country. They can start to put people on ballots in cities and be able to, you know, do the kind of things that they did in Wisconsin virtually in every state in the country. And then that becomes really, really powerful.
I want to talk a little bit about what's happening with Occupy DC in and of itself. But before I do that, I want to ask our listeners, you know, every day I ask for people to become members of this program. And today I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do it tomorrow, and I'll do it every day after that. But today, what I want to ask of our audience is if you have a couple of bucks. It's not going to take much if we all do it. It's going to take pennies if we all do it. But not everyone does it. But we have a link on our site at majority.fm right now. You can also find it in Jeff's Twitter feed at Don't Be a Putz. I want you folks to help Jeff get down there and be able to finance what he's going to do. Hopefully we'll have him on this program next Tuesday, calling in, giving us updates. And throughout the week, I will be in D.C. Thursday and Friday. And so I'm glad to hear there'll be more actions going on. And so we'll figure out something then. But I want to be able to get updates from Jeff all week. And folks, you know, if you have a couple of dollars, you cannot go down to Washington yourself. You can send Jeff down there, help him out, make it possible for him to go down there. It is on our site at majority.fm.
You PayPal haters, there are no excuses. This is using wepay.com, so there's no reason to not donate.
It's not through PayPal. It's wepay.com. We have the URL on our site at majority.fm. Is there a quick and dirty URL for it, Jeff?
No, I don't think so, actually.
Next time, do a bit.ly link, and you can custom it. But so go to majority.fm. Folks, anything you can give, help Jeff get down there. He's doing yeoman's work, and both in terms of the actual protests and relating it to the rest of the country. And we're very, very lucky to have a guy like Jeff working on these type of things on all of our behalf down at Occupy. And so I want to just touch on this before I let you go. Down in D.C., you know, I read the other day a statement by Kevin Zeese out of Occupy D.C., and there's a little bit of controversy down there because there seems to be two different camps, one that is at McPherson Square and one that is at Freedom Plaza. And I think Freedom Plaza has actually been shut down. It was a 3-day permit that was an anti-war thing. So when you guys go down there, will people start to camp out at one of these spaces? Will you head to McPherson Square? What happens? What's the mechanics when people from Occupy Wall Street, New York, head down to Occupy D.C.?
Yes, there are definitely two camps, and the Kevin Zeese one is in, as you said, the Freedom Plaza, which is a much bigger space, although I believe there are fewer people certainly there that are sleeping there. The McPherson Square, which is on the other side of the White House, on K Street, I believe, is the more grassroots, if you will, Occupy Wall Street. And they still have about, 150 tents or so. When it's cold, maybe, 100 people will sleep there. When it gets a little warmer, maybe 200 or 300 people will sleep there. So they still actually have a pretty good sized camp. I will be probably doing a combination of, couch surfing or, sleeping out there, depending on how things go. You just sort of have to wing it to a certain degree. But there's definitely a difference. And for this event in particular, early on, there was word that SEIU and the sort of traditional Democratic allies were looking to co-opt this event. And from talking with the organizers in the more anarchist side of the Occupy DC, they've sort of made nice for this day, but it's really all the organizing is coming from the more anarchist one, at least that we're talking about. But really that's part of why I want to go down there and be a part of this, because if it does somehow become co-opted or turned into some kind of a Van Jones event, I want to be there to, basically mic check Van Jones if I have to. I mean, this movement's not going to allow the Democratic Party to just neuter us in a way by trying to equivocate our message with theirs. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons why even when Obama wins, Occupy Wall Street's going to continue to be important, because, you know, your guest was actually great, and I couldn't agree more about the idea of media becoming more like the people's property and us actually using it to communicate so that we can elect a president. And so I see Occupy Wall Street as just as important of a way to educate Americans that it's time to turn off CNN and to learn what websites you need to go to and, you know, what podcasts or what places on YouTube, and really start to, you know, foster a real revolution that way. I mean, it's enough with trying to channel it through the two existing parties. And so, you know, I really think that if we can mobilize enough people, we can just take over our government peacefully, just like make them literally irrelevant.
You know, the other, I think, sort of fascinating aspect about this for me is to watch over the course of these months where Occupy is not dominating the headlines in the way that it did in the fall, to see the sort of the mechanical growth of the movement. Because every time someone like you goes down there, and every time people from around the country focus on one thing, and these things are hammered out between the sort of the more anarchist strains and the more sort of institutional strains that run through Occupy Wall Street, more and more people are learning of how to organize, how to mobilize, and so when the spring comes and when things become more active, and as they will become, I think not just in 2012, but in 2013 and beyond, people are laying the foundation, and the maybe institutional is not necessarily the right word, but there is a real understanding of how to make these things work, which I think is a challenge that people don't fully grasp, is how big that challenge is.
I definitely agree, but you also have to think of this. I mean, you know, some people have said, oh, since they cleared the park, the movement's not much, what are they doing lately? But the general assemblies that we have gone literally uninterrupted since day one, and they continue to this day, and that sort of points to the perseverance of the people in this movement, the fact that every single day they get up and they go back and they try and do it again and again. And so it really mirrors what was going on in the park, in saying, you know, there is no possible way you can ignore us. And when you have that kind of a force, you do. You just continue to pick up people like a snowball, you know, rolling down a hill. And, you know, the same way that it took the Republican Party 30 years to really market and message and create the sort of monster we deal with now, it's going to take the same thing to undo it and make people realize the government isn't the problem and that we are the government and it's time to get involved. And I think that really scares them. You know?
All right, folks, again, come to majority.fm. We will have a link to Jeff Smith's WePay account. Send him down there. He wants to go down with a full set of Gucci bags and styling. We've got a stretch limo to bring him down there. We are going to get him some very fashionable I don't know. What's the name of a fashionable furniture? I don't know. We're all looking like...
I guess anything but IKEA.
Yeah, something, nice high-end crate and barrel. I don't even know what those names of those Henry Gold couches to sleep on or whatever that company is. So go to majority.fm. Send Jeff down there. Show your support. Show your appreciation for the work he's doing. And hopefully, Jeff, we'll be talking to you multiple times next week.
That sounds great.
All right. Jeff Smith from Occupy Wall Street. Folks, that is the lesser half of our show today. And if you can imagine, we just did an hour of lesser half material. And now we go into the better half of the program, wherein I take your phone calls at 646-257-3920. You want to tell me what you thought about Rocky Anderson? Please do. You want to tell me what your hopes are for Occupy Wall Street, please do. We'll be talking about the New Hampshire primary. We'll be taking your IMs at Majority FM. You can Skype us at Majority Live.
update on what's happening in Indiana. Update on that story of the EPA delivering water to a township in Pennsylvania because the frackers have fracked up their water supply. That and more, all on the better half of the program. No plea for membership today, only a plea that you head to majority.fm to help out, send Jeff Smith down to Occupy DC. And he'll be giving us regular reports next week. You know the different ways you can support the program, but we'll save that for tomorrow. See you in the better half, folks.